Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 180. It's Monday, September 12th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is still roiling about in the country, and it's actually a little higher, a little worse, and going up in Lucas County. So I'm going to do two stories about COVID, the local update, and we'll get to a whole bunch of non-COVID stories. So, first up, from Medical Express, research shows that all COVID-19 infections include a wide mix of SARS-CoV-2 virus variants. Researchers at Case Western University found wide genetic variation in SARS-CoV-2 viruses among 360 patients whose viral infections were genetically sequenced, showing that all individual infections include multiple variants of the virus. These data were developed in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic when the Alpha variant and then the Delta variant were of major concern. This work showed that mutations found in Omicron BA1 and BA2 were already present as relatively minor variations at least a year before Omicron and its many iterations became, quote, variants of concern. Omicron and its own variants were central to the major COVID-19 resurgence last winter, and of course the continuing plateau, if you surge, whatever you want to call it, that's going on now, is just a seemingly unending lineup of Omicron and its variants. And of course, there's a new one that's becoming more emergent, the BA4.6, which of course, BA5 is the most dominant in the U.S. as a whole, but in the smack dab in the central of the country, in Iowa, in Missouri, in Nebraska, I'm forgetting the fourth state, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, those four states are all contiguous to each other, that now that BA4.6 is actually the dominant variant, seems to have a competitive advantage over the BA4 and BA5. Even more immune escape potential. And this interesting Case Western Reserve University study seems to indicate that, you know, when we measure variants, typically they just look for the one that's the overwhelming majority and they just call it that variant. But in fact, every single infection they looked among all 360 patients had multiple variants present. So this might explain some of the reason why the variants continue to mutate and recombine and just creating more and more trouble as the persistence and stubbornness of COVID-19, particularly this Omicron variant, to kind of just weasel its way around our immune systems and continue to cause hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of infections each day in the U.S. Okay, well, next up, some of you may have heard that the White House is sort of shifting gears a little bit and trying to fall into this pattern of maybe doing annual boosters, something similar to the way we do with flu season. And there's a really good commentary here from your local epidemiologist. Here it is. One shot per year. We really need to step up our game then. The White House announced a new plan, one COVID-19 shot per year. The idea is that this will decrease public confusion and increase booster uptake by aligning with the flu vaccine campaign, which, by the way, I'll say is not really all that successful as far as getting wide coverage. Flu vaccines work, but you gotta take them. Reading between the lines, I think this is also a political signal to shift out of the SARS-CoV-2 emergency phase. Will an annual shot plan work? Maybe, but there's a lot that needs to align beforehand, and I certainly hope this doesn't mean we are accepting our current state of affairs with vaccines. The stars need to align. The annual COVID-19 plan largely follows our flu model: evaluate circulating strains and update the vaccine before the flu season. This model works for the flu for three main reasons. One, flu is clearly seasonal. The predictability of the flu allows us to time vaccine recommendations so that vaccine companies can manufacture and distribute by winter. A six-month flu season also means that we really only need our flu to cover the winter months. In other words, the vaccine can wane, particularly among older populations. Two, flu mutations have direction. As I have written before, the flu mutates in a ladder-like pattern. This allows us to predict the direction the flu may be mutating. Three, flu has been around for decades, which has allowed us to develop and refine global surveillance systems to identify emerging strains. SARS-CoV-2 is mutating four times faster than the flu. It's not seasonal nor annual. It's not mutating in a ladder-like form, and we do not have a global surveillance system in place. We expect and hope that COVID-19 will eventually be like the flu, but to assume that has already happened is premature. I also think it is a gamble as the virus continues to surprise us. To pivot the public again is risky. The fall bivalent vaccine is also our first attempt to apply the flu model to SARS-CoV-2. This is our pilot, and we really need to see how the pilot works in the real world before making sweeping declarations like an annual shot. We need the data, the time, and the humility to tell. Let's first get through winter. We need to up our vaccine game. The annual COVID-19 booster plan also means the White House has one goal: prevent severe disease and death. And our first generation vaccines can do this well. In fact, the first generation vaccine saved an estimated 20 million lives across the globe in 1 year. However, we can and should do better. This does not mean boosting our way out of the pandemic, but it means leveraging innovation and science to develop next-generation vaccines that last longer and or prevent infection or transmission. This would have immense positive ripple effects. It would slow transmission. It could slow viral mutations. It would slow morbidity, such as long COVID-19. It could sunset the pandemic. Next-generation vaccines include mucosal vaccines. Nasal and or oral vaccines would provide more protection against infection and transmission. For instance, it could be sterilizing immunity. 13 nasal vaccines are currently in development. These work very differently from our current vaccines as they target mucosal immunity. Mucosal tissue is all over our body, including our nose and throats. In fact, it's the largest component of our immune system, is one of the first defenses with the elements in the real world. By providing immunity there, instead of deep within our circulatory system, we could prevent infection in the first place. Clinical trial data is incredibly promising, especially when used as a booster as opposed to the primary series. This week, China approved the world's first inhaled booster against COVID-19. And next up in next generation vaccines, pan-coronavirus vaccines. The next best thing to sterilizing immunity would be a variant-proof vaccine that lasts longer and works against all coronaviruses. So that would not only just be SARS-CoV-2, but even other common cold viruses and potentially any other future potential pandemic that would come from the coronavirus family. Flu and COVID-19 combo vaccines. At the very least, we need one vaccine that contains both the flu and COVID-19 vaccine formula. These next-generation vaccines are obtainable. We are well on our way, but this cannot be accomplished without investment from Congress. It costs an estimated $1 billion to develop and test a drug or vaccine from start to finish. And it takes risk, as not every vaccine makes it through clinical trials. Money will move mountains in science and research, but we need a push from the public and a push from the administration. we need an Operation Warp Speed 2.0. The White House plans to have only one booster per year. This plan may or may not be a good one, as the stars would need to align for it to be effective. Regardless, next-generation vaccines need to be part of this conversation, as they are a critical solution for better health. We just need to fight for it. Okay, now let's get to the Lucas County COVID-19 update. As I mentioned earlier, there's plenty of COVID rolling around and seems to be going up in Lucas County. The number of reported cases went up to an average of 127 per day from 122 the previous week. Of course, this is a huge undercount, but the direction does not look good. And that's been a trend that's gone over the last month. The testing positivity rates actually went up in Lucas County while they're trending down in Ohio and U.S. The test positivity rate was 18% in Lucas County, 17% in Ohio, and about 13% in the U.S. Nursing home active COVID-19 cases stayed about the same at 64. Identified active cases in long-term care facilities, that's down from 65 and 70 the week before. And it's pretty much evenly split between residents and staff. Fortunately, there are no additional deaths reported from long-term care facilities from COVID-19. In some good news, hospitalization and ICU patients in the U.S. continues to decline. Ohio is holding fairly steady, and unfortunately, Lucas County is actually increasing. The deaths nationally do seem to be declining, but it's hard to tell because holidays have historically shown dips and delays in reporting, so we'll have to wait for 2 or 3 weeks for that to kind of sort itself out. And locally, the boosters are available for everybody over age 12, and the Toledo Lucas County Health Department downtown is offering a walk-in booster clinics where you can get a free booster, and this is Monday through Friday in their regular business hours. Okay, well, that's it for the local COVID-19 report. Next up from the Hill, an Ohio story. Unfortunately, since the title is The 10 Most Polluted States in the United States. How clean are the air and water in your state? Using 2021 data, U.S. News and World Reports feature on the best states has ranked U.S. states in several metrics, including economics, education, and healthcare. The listing also measures natural environment, which is based on the state's air and water quality and pollution levels. Pollution was determined based on air and water emissions from industry and utilities and overall measures to long-term human health effects using information from the Environmental Protection Agency. So, the states with the worst pollution, ranking last, Louisiana. Second to last, Nevada, then Indiana, Delaware, Utah, and in at 45th out of 50 states, Ohio. So Ohio, in most health metrics, does tend to fare poorly, somewhere from low to mid-30s to about this, although that 45th out of 50 is about as bad as we rank, but we're usually way below average. But unfortunately, just more confirmation that we have plenty of health problems here to deal with. And this one disappointed me a little bit because I don't know why, but whatever, just pollution. You'd think that we'd get our act together, but apparently we haven't. So that's the way it is. Ohio ranks 45th out of 50 states on pollution. Okay, next up's a story about our nearby neighbor Michigan and their abortion laws, which of course affect Ohio a lot since it's not available legally in Ohio. This from NPR. A 1931 law criminalizing abortion in Michigan is unconstitutional, a judge rules. Enforcement of Michigan's 1931 abortion ban was blocked last Wednesday by a judge who replaced her temporary order with a permanent injunction. Michigan Court of Claims Judge Elizabeth Gleicher ruled the Michigan Constitution's Due Process Clause is expansive enough to cover reproductive rights. The Michigan Constitution protects the right of all pregnant people to make autonomous health decisions, she wrote, and later wrote, exercising the right to bodily integrity means exercising the right to determine when in her life a woman will be best prepared physically, emotionally, and financially to be a mother. Dr. Sarah Wallet, the chief medical officer for Planned Parenthood of Michigan, says this means abortion rights are protected while there's still a lot of litigation pending. This is one of several abortion-related legal cases in play in Michigan. It could join at least three decisions that have been appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court. There is also a separate case that seeks to put an abortion rights amendment in the November ballot. And we have an update to that. Yes, that was approved. The judge said that should go onto the ballot. So Michigan voters will be voting on a constitutional amendment that would secure reproductive rights. Go Michigan. Your future and fate will affect ours in Ohio a lot, as particularly as a border community here in Toledo, Lucas County. We'd love to have access right across the border to reproductive health services, since our own state doesn't seem to deem that fit for us. Okay, well, next up, let's go back and do a couple more infectious disease stories, since unfortunately, even beyond COVID, this seems to be an emerging issue in the landscape of health in America. This from The Hill. Governor Hochul declares polio emergency in New York after more virus found in wastewater. New York Governor Kathy Hochul declared a disaster in the state last Friday due to the spread of polio through wastewater. The emergency declaration allows a larger group of medical personnel to administer polio vaccines and requires providers to send immunization data to the New York State Health Department. On polio, we simply cannot roll the dice, State Health Commissioner Mary Bassett said in response to Hochul's order. She continued, if you or your child are unvaccinated or not up to date with vaccinations, the risk of paralytic disease is real. Polio immunization is safe and effective, protecting nearly all people against disease who receive the recommended doses. Polio vaccines will now be able to be distributed by first responders, midwives, and pharmacists. The State Health Department wastewater surveillance found poliovirus in stool samples collected in Rockland County, Orange County, Sullivan County, New York City, and Nassau County, all of which are clustered in the southeast of the state. So this emergency order was based on the fact that since they ramped up their surveillance in the contiguous counties, nearby counties, where it was originally detected in Rockland, of course, it's all over and basically everywhere in the southeast of the state. And this is really important for everybody in the country to look, because if it doesn't get contained there, polio is highly infectious. And because you actually get it, it mimics other diseases that are easily missed as a mild polio infection. And it takes hundreds of those infections before you actually get to the paralytic disease, which is a really serious outcome. But the fact is, so that paralytic disease and the serious polio outcomes is a very small tip of the iceberg. So under the water, they have a lot of transmission of polio. And the question is, if and when that will become widespread across the country. For better or worse, and probably worse, this is likely due to the anti-vaccine movement in the United States. And I guess if you're anti-vaccine, you consider that a win, that we can just, get polio to get rid of polio. I must admit, I have a hard time making sense of that conspiracy sphere. But I'll take a shot here. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, let's get to the next infectious disease story. This from ABC News. What Australia's flu season could foreshadow in the U.S. this fall. Australia is nearing the end of its worst flu season in the last 5 years, which could be a sign of what's to come to the United States heading into the fall and winter. Researchers and modelers often look to the southern hemisphere, which experienced its flu season first, typically from May to October, to predict how the season will look in the U.S., and experts tell ABC News we should take warning from Australia. We often look to Australia and the southern hemisphere as a signal of what we may expect, said Dr. John Brownstein, an epidemiologist at Boston Children's Hospital. Obviously, it's not a perfect one-to-one match, but more often than not, the severity of the flu season in Australia is a good correlate of what we might expect, and it helps us prepare. During the last 2 years, not as many cases were reported in the U.S. compared to previous years due to COVID-19-related mitigation measures in place, such as mask wearing and social distancing, as well as school and business closures. One study from Wayne State University looking at Detroit Medical Center found that there were no positive tests for influenza A or B among adults or children during the 2020 to 2021 flu season. However, during the 2019 to 20 flu season, just prior to the pandemic, 13% of adult tests and 20% of children's tests were positive for the virus. Another study examining Akron Children's Hospital, Ohio, found no cases of influenza A and just 2 cases of influenza B were detected during the 2020 to 2021 season, a 99% decrease from the prior season. But with COVID-19 expected to peak again in December 2022 or January 2023, and with less flu immunity among the population and fewer mitigation measures, this could be the first time Americans have to grapple with 2 respiratory viruses at the same time, which could put a further strain on hospital systems. Given the concerns we have about healthcare capacity and healthcare burnout, the last thing we want is to have parallel epidemics at a time when our health system are stretched thin, Dr. Brownstein said. Health experts said they are highly recommending Americans to get their flu shots by the end of October to get the best protection, but say it's never too late, even if people get the shot later in the season. While COVID has dominated headlines for years now, we have to remember that flu is a serious infection, and while most who get the flu recover, we have to recognize that flu leads to tens of thousands of hospitalizations and thousands of deaths. A portion of flu infections could result in severe illness and death. Just like we try to mitigate risk of COVID infection, we have to try to provide a similar effort against flu infection. Okay, well, next up, I'd like to do a series of stories on American healthcare. First up, from the Associated Press, Americans give healthcare system failing mark, according to an Associated Press poll. The poll reveals that public satisfaction with the U.S. healthcare system is remarkably low, with fewer than half of Americans saying it is generally handled well. Only 12% say it is handled extremely or very well. Americans have similar views about healthcare for older adults. Overall, the public gives even lower marks for how prescription drug costs, the quality of care at nursing homes, and mental health care are being handled, with just 6% or less saying those health services are done very well in the country. In fact, the poll shows an overwhelming majority of Americans, nearly 8 in 10, say they're at least moderately concerned about getting access to quality health care when they need it. Black and Hispanic adults in particular are resoundingly worried about health care access, with nearly 6 in 10 saying they're very or extremely concerned about getting good care. Fewer than half of white adults, 44%, express the same level of worry. Still striking levels in all populations. Racial disparities have long troubled America's healthcare system. They have been abundantly clear during the COVID-19 pandemic, with Black and Hispanic people dying disproportionately from the virus. Black and Hispanic men also make up disproportionately high rates of recent monkeypox infections. 53% of women said they are extremely or very concerned about obtaining quality care, compared to 42% of men. Of course, this reflects the general gender divide, is that women are much more concerned about health than men. Doesn't necessarily mean that how much difference there actually is. A lot of it just a perception of gender. Although, frankly, women do probably get worse health care for a variety of reasons I've reported on in the past. While Americans are united in their dissatisfaction with the healthcare system, that agreement breaks down when it comes to solutions to fix it. About two-thirds of adults do think it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure all Americans have healthcare coverage, with adults age 18 to 49 more likely than those over 50 to hold that view. The percentage of people who believe healthcare coverage is a government responsibility has risen in recent years, ticking up from 57% in 2019 and 62% in 2017. Still, there's not consensus on how that coverage might be delivered. About 4 in 10 Americans say they support single-payer healthcare system that would require Americans to get their health insurance from a government plan. More, 58%, say they favor a government health insurance plan that anyone can purchase. There also is a broad support for policies that would help Americans pay for the cost of long-term care, including a government-administered insurance plan similar to Medicare, the federal government's health insurance for people 65 and older. 80% said they support the federal government negotiating for lower drug prices. A majority of Americans, roughly two-thirds, were happy to see the government step in to provide free COVID-19 testing, vaccines, and treatment. Roughly 2 in 10 were neutral about the government's response. So you can take from that, there wasn't a lot of people that were really unhappy getting care with the COVID pandemic. And given the sentiment that most people are not real happy with American health care, we definitely need to do something about it. I think by far the most rational, sensible, and cost-effective is health care for all. Single payer, all the better.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Well, in the current political environment, healthcare for all may be sort of a pipe dream, but hey, I am more than willing to work and wait as long as it takes. But I have a few stories talking about some of these around the edges incremental changes, which are good news, not the big news, but some good news. This first up from MedPage Today. Biden administration reverses Trump area public charge rule. Non-citizens can receive or apply for health benefits and other services without hurting the chances of securing permanent residency status, a green card, thanks to a final rule from the Department of Homeland Security issued last Thursday. The rule centers around the contentious public charge reason for inadmissibility and focuses on clarifying how DHS will not punish non-citizens. Specifically, non-citizens seeking admission into the U.S. or lawful permanent residency from within its borders for availing themselves of health-related benefits and government services for which they qualify, such as Medicaid, with some exceptions including long-term institutions like nursing homes, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. In a press release, the Secretary Xavier Becerra said that people who qualify for Medicaid, CHIP, and other health programs should receive the care they need without fear of jeopardizing their immigration status. As the COVID-19 pandemic has made clear, it's in all Americans' best interest to leverage healthcare and other services to improve public health for everyone, he noted. Moira Szilagyi, past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, called the Biden administration's new rule, quote, a welcome and overdue step to protect immigrant families. Pediatricians have witnessed the chilling effects of the prior administration's harmful changes to this policy in our own patients, with families disenrolling from or avoiding critical health care, nutrition, and housing programs for which they or their children were eligible. The work to undo these impacts will take time and additional action from the federal government, she said in a statement. She stressed that given the disproportionate toll of the pandemic on Black and Hispanic families, all federal agencies must make clear, consistent communications to families that they can access needed health care without fear. We are committed to doing our job as pediatricians, providing care to children, and working to ensure they are eligible for and can access nutritious food, safe and stable housing, and economic supports regardless of their immigration status. We urge the government to continue its efforts to do the same. And next up, tucked away in the Inflation Reduction Act, this from WESA Radio. Climate law has a hidden benefit for coal miners, permanent funding for Black lung. Passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, the Democrats' large climate and health care bill, included one provision aiming to help miners afflicted by Black lung disease. For years, Congress has passed temporary extensions of a tax on coal to fund the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. The fund pays about $149 million annually in benefits and health care costs for miners with Black lung disease whose former employers have gone bankrupt. Congress has periodically let the tax expire, including at the end of 2021, further pushing the program into the red. The Inflation Reduction Act, signed by President Biden last month, reinstated the tax and made it permanent. Even with a permanent extension of the tax, Black lung benefits could face a long-term funding problem. The Black Lung Disability Trust Fund is already about $5 billion in debt. As more coal mines close, it will be paying less money into the fund. But miners will continue getting sick long after they stop working. Some forms of it are on the rise in Appalachia, especially among younger miners. About 1 in 5 miners in Appalachia show signs of black lung, according to the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. It's not going to decrease the amount of black lung for decades because black lung is a latent and progressive disease. Many miners will be fine at the time they retire, and 10, 20 years later, the disease may develop because the coal dust, once in the lungs, is never out of the lungs, so it continues to work in there for a long, long time. And next up, we have a story that seems to typify the pharmaceutical-driven healthcare that we have in this country. This from the Associated Press. FDA panel backs much-debated ALS drug in rare second review. A panel of federal health advisors voted last Wednesday to recommend approval for an experimental drug to treat Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, a remarkable turnaround for the much-debated medication that was previously rejected by the same group earlier this year. The Food and Drug Administration advisors voted 7-2 that data from Amylyx Pharma warranted approval, despite hours of debate about the strength and reliability of the company's lone study. The FDA is not required to follow the group's advice, but its positive recommendation suggests an approval is likely later this month. ALS patients and their families have rallied behind the Amylyx's drug, launching an aggressive lobbying campaign and enlisting members of Congress to push the FDA to grant approval. To deprive ALS parents of a drug that might work, it's probably not something I would feel terribly comfortable with, said Dr. Liana Apostolova of Indiana University School of Medicine, who voted for the approval. At the previous meeting, it wasn't that clear, and it's still questionable. Amylyx also appeared to benefit from an unusual exchange in which a company executive, at the FDA's request, committed to pull the drug from the market if its benefits aren't confirmed by a large ongoing study. Dr. Billy Dunn, FDA's neurology review chief, opened the meeting by detailing the, quote, concerns and limitations with Amylyx's data, while emphasizing the need for new treatment options. In a highly unusual move, Dunn suggested the agency might be more willing to approve the drug if Amylyx would commit to withdrawing its medication if the ongoing 600-patient trial fails to show a benefit. He then called on the company's co-founders to publicly commit to that step, and Amylyx's co-CEO, Justin Klee, said the company would voluntarily withdraw its drug in that scenario. The FDA has the power to force companies to pull drugs from the market, though it's generally faster if drug makers voluntarily take that step. In cases where companies resist removal, the regulatory process can drag on for years. I think the FDA, with all due respect, significantly understates the complexity and likelihood of their pulling the product voluntarily from the market, said Dr. Caleb Alexander of Johns Hopkins University, one of the two panelists who voted against the drug. The final result for a single study is borderline and not very statistically persuasive, FDA statistician Tristan Massey told panelists. Yeah, well, and of course I looked up what the projected price. Of course, it hasn't hit the market, so they haven't set a price, but it's expected, get this, that this drug per year will cost on the order of $170,000 for a drug that frankly probably doesn't work. Yikes. Well, you're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, folks, pharmaceutical companies certainly get their cut and do their share of damage as well as whatever good they do. But, of course, legal drugs led by alcohol kills more people than even illicit drug overdoses. So let's do this next story from Medical Express. Researchers suggest it's time for updated warning labels on alcoholic beverages. A pair of researchers, one with Harvard School of Public Health and the other with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, are suggesting that it's time to update the warning labels that appear on bottles and cans containing alcohol-based beverages made for sale to the public. In their paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Anna Grumman and Marissa Hall point out that such labels have not been updated in several decades, and that research efforts have shown that such beverages pose a significant public health hazard. In 1989, warning labels in the U.S. began appearing on bottles and cans of beverages that contain alcohol, noting that drinking such products came with risks that included driving while intoxicated. They also noted that drinking while pregnant could harm a yet-to-be-born baby. Some other minor health risks were occasionally noted. Such warning labels have been updated since then, but only words have changed. The messages remain the same. In this new effort, Grumman and Hall suggest that an update is in order because researchers have found that consuming alcohol can lead to a host of medical problems. The researchers begin their argument by noting that earlier this year, the CDC published mortality statistics showing that consumption of alcohol now leads to approximately 140,000 deaths every year. As an editorial note, that is more than illicit drug overdoses, although while both alcohol-related deaths and illicit drug overdoses are increasing, the overdoses might be increasing faster, so it's a race. They further note that the pandemic has only made the problem worse. They go on to say that most Americans do not know that scientists have found health problems related to drinking, other than those who occur due to car crashes or other kinds of accidents. They point out that drinking alcohol has been shown to increase the chances of a person developing hypertension, cirrhosis, heart disease, and cancer, even for light drinkers. They suggest that comparing the content of current warning labels with the actual risks involved in drinking alcohol borders on being misleading. The researchers then note that updating alcohol labels would not be unprecedented. The tobacco industry has done it repeatedly. They also note that simply forcing distributors to change the message would not be enough. Prior research has shown that the message must be prominently placed. And in an interesting sidebar on drug use in the U.S., this from USA Today, Marijuana use is outpacing cigarette use for the first time ever in the U.S., new poll says. For the first time on record, more people in the United States are smoking marijuana instead of nicotine cigarettes, a new Gallup poll reveals. It's the latest evidence to show the dramatic shift in people's attitudes over the substances. The poll from July comes as cigarette use has been on a downward spiral over the past decade plus. Only 11% of adults in the U.S. say they smoke cigarettes nowadays, compared with 45% in the same poll in the 1950s. On the flip side, marijuana has been up across the board on a wave of legalization in many U.S. states. 16% of Americans in the poll indicated they smoke marijuana, including 48% who say they have tried it over their lifetime. Compare that number to just 4% in the same poll from 1969. And back to sort of legal drugs, this from Associated Press. Juul to pay nearly $440 million to settle state's teen vaping probe. Electronic cigarette maker Juul Labs has agreed to pay nearly $440 million to settle a two-year investigation by 33 states into the marketing of its high-nicotine vaping products, which have long been blamed for sparking a national surge in teen vaping. The settlement, which includes numerous restrictions on how Juul can market its products, resolves one of the biggest legal threats facing the beleaguered company, which still faces nine separate lawsuits from other states. Additionally, Juul faces hundreds of personal lawsuits brought on behalf of teenagers and others who say they became addicted to the company's vaping products. The state's investigation found that Juul marketed its e-cigarettes to underage teens with launch parties, product giveaways, and ads in social media posts using youthful models. The settlement total amounts to about 25% of Juul's U.S. sales of $1.9 billion last year. Most of the limits imposed by the settlement won't immediately affect Juul, which halted use of parties, giveaways, and other promotions after coming under scrutiny several years ago. The company currently makes up about one-third of the U.S. retail vaping market, down from 75% several years ago. Juul has agreed to refrain from a host of marketing practices as part of the settlement. They include not using cartoons, paying social media influencers, depicting people under 35, advertising on billboards and public transportation, and placing ads in any outlets unless 85% of their audience are adults. The deal also includes restrictions on where Juul products may be placed in stores, age verification on all sales, and limits to online and retail sales. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do a few stories on food and nutrition. First up from the New York Times, food insecurity for families with children reached two-decade low in 2021. Food insecurity for households with children declined to its lowest rate in two decades last year, the Agriculture Department said last Wednesday, as government assistance programs continue to blunt the effect of the coronavirus on the economy. The department's findings were in line with data last year showing that vast expansions of government aid helped reduce hunger. But experts warned that picture was almost certain to change as pandemic-era programs expire and inflation remains high. The social safety net for families with children was more generous in 2021 than it has been and better than it is now, said Sarah Bowen, a sociology professor at North Carolina State University and an expert in food insecurity. This shows that food insecurity is a solvable problem. We have the power to fix it. In a report released last Wednesday, the Agriculture Department said that about 4.6 million households with children were food insecure at some point, a rate of 12.5%. That was the lowest rate since at least 1998, the oldest year with comparable data. But for households without children, particularly for women and seniors living alone, food insecurity actually increased. Unfortunately, Ms. Bowen added, the report also shows that it can get worse if we do nothing. Data released last year showed the food insecurity remained unchanged in spite of mass unemployment and an economic downturn brought on by the pandemic. The finding was at odds with past experiences when recessions led to a spike in hunger. Experts attributed that shift to big expansions of government aid, which continued into 2021, and additional changes to food assistance programs. Among them were an expansion of the child tax credit, which gave most families hundreds of dollars a month, pandemic legislation which increased benefits for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and made school meals universally free, and an emergency program that reimbursed families for missed school meals. Experts said that the portrait of hunger in the United States would change this year, given that many of the system programs had lapsed. Even though we have evidence that these policies worked, we haven't managed to preserve most of them, Professor Bowen said. And next up from NBC News, why chain restaurants are going on diets. The convenience of eating out comes at a price to our health. Since the 1970s, we have doubled the amount of calories we consume eating outside our homes, with a third of adults in the U.S. eating fast food on any given day. Over the past 30 years, the average entree at fast food restaurants has 90 more calories than it used to, while calories in desserts at these restaurants have increased by double that, 180 calories. Woo! Compared to eating in, eating out generally means we eat less fruits and vegetables while consuming more calories, fat, and salt. And aside from a brief dip in 2020, over the past decade, we have consistently spent more money on food outside the home compared to food we eat at home. Calorie labor requirements on menus can help, though not necessarily in the way you might expect. This makes it even more challenging for people to stick to their recommended daily calorie intake, and increasing portion sizes and calories have at least in part contributed to the obesity epidemic. While there is no simple solution to the problem, the federal government implemented regulations requiring restaurants that have 20 or more locations nationwide to display the total calories or calorie range besides food items. Research is finally starting to trickle in that assess whether this change is having an effect. According to the findings, calorie labor requirements on menus can help, though not necessarily in the way expected. Instead of diners, it's the restaurants themselves most likely to go on diets. While the labeling has been shown to decrease calories consumed by consumers to a small degree, they have likely been shown to decrease the number of calories for new menu items at restaurants. More dramatic is the way restaurants are cutting back when they introduce new menu items. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association last year examined more than 35,000 menu items at fast food restaurants, fast casual restaurants, full service restaurants, and coffee shops. New menu items that were introduced after the regulation contained on average 25% fewer calories, though those previously introduced stayed the same. This translated to more than 100 calories per menu item. For fast food chains specifically, the decrease was even greater, at 180 calories per item. This reduction in calories was also seen in supermarkets, which were required to show calorie labels on prepared foods beginning in 2018. A study published last year by the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that while new and continued entrees, sides, cheeses, and deli meats didn't change in calorie count, bakery items did show a significant caloric decrease. For new introduced bakery items, the difference was a whopping 440 calorie reduction per item. The authors did note that these new bakery items were smaller, and it could not be determined completely whether the consumers would simply buy more. It would be helpful to take this idea further and inform consumers about specific nutrients, which calorie labels do not offer. Since 2016, Chile, Israel, Mexico, Peru, and Uruguay have required nutrient warnings such as high in added sugars on packages and have been successful. In Chile, for example, sugary beverages purchases decreased by a quarter after the implementation of these warnings. The U.S. should follow suit. Obesity is a complex problem, and the solutions are also often complex. Calorie labeling alone won't fix the problem, but it's easy to institute and can make a difference. Restaurants are cutting back, and with calorie labels, maybe the rest of us can too. And next up from USA Today, Western diet, sedentary lifestyle, likely factors in global rise in cancer for adults age 50 and under. Cancer is on the rise among adults under the age of 50, new research suggests. Early onset cases of cancer of the breast, colon, esophagus, kidney, liver, and pancreas are among those that have risen worldwide since about 1990, according to a study by researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and published this week in their peer-reviewed journal, Nature Reviews Clinical Oncology. The likely culprit? Increasingly sedentary lifestyles and a Western diet chock full of processed foods. While increased detection of cancer at earlier ages plays a part in the rise of early onset cancer, enhanced screening alone does not account for the increase in 14 different types of cancer among under age 50 adults from 2000 to 2012, researchers said. Each successive group of people born at a later time have a higher risk of developing cancer earlier in life, likely due to risk factors they were exposed to at a young age, said Dr. Shuju Ogino, a professor and physician scientist at Brigham Women's Hospital Department of Pathology, in a summary of the research on the hospital's website. Those born in 1960, for example, have a higher risk of developing cancer than those born in 1950. We found that this risk is increasing with each generation. We predict that this risk level will continue to climb in successive generations. The median age for a cancer diagnosis is 66, according to the National Cancer Institute. Certain cancer risk factors include highly processed foods, sugary beverages, obesity, type 2 diabetes, sedentary lifestyle, and alcohol consumption have all increased since the 1950s, the researchers said. Researchers did not identify specific increases in risk in the various cancers, but overall, more people globally are less healthy. Those unhealthy behaviors are likely increasing cancer rates at younger ages, they said. Among the 14 cancer types on the rise that we studied, 8 were related to the digestive system. The food we eat feeds the microorganisms in our gut, said the study's lead author, Dr. Tomotaka Ugai, also in the hospital's pathology department. Eventually, these changes can influence disease risks and outcomes. Researchers worldwide should collaborate to better monitor global trends and a potential global cancer epidemic, the researchers said. More in-depth lifelong studies, including children, can also help track possible impacts of environmental factors. And ongoing research should include specimens from cancers to determine possible differences between early onset cases and those found later in life. So once again, lifestyle factors play a huge role in our leading causes of death, in this case, cancer. Okay, well, last up, a very interesting story from Medical Express. Frequency of premenstrual anxiety mood swings, a public health issue study finds. Premenstrual mood swings and anxiety are so common, experienced by more than 64% of women, that they represent a key public health issue globally, according to a new University of Virginia health study. The University of Virginia health study found that most women have premenstrual symptoms every menstrual cycle, and those symptoms regularly affect their day-to-day lives. One of the most common symptoms, regardless of age, is mood swings or anxiety, the researchers found. At least 61% of women in all age groups survey reported mood-related symptoms every menstrual cycle, which the researchers say suggests that premenstrual mood symptoms are a key public health issue globally. The most common symptoms reported were food cravings, experienced by 85% of the women surveyed, followed by mood swings or anxiety, 64%, and fatigue, 57%. Among the study respondents, 29% said their premenstrual symptoms interfered with their everyday life during every menstrual cycle, while an additional 35% said their premenstrual symptoms interfered with their everyday life sometimes. A group of symptoms, absent-mindedness, low libido, sleep changes, gastrointestinal symptoms, weight gain, headaches, sweating or hot flashes, fatigue, hair changes, rashes, and swelling, was significantly more frequent among older survey respondents, the researchers found. The increase in physical symptoms among older survey respondents makes sense, the researchers said, as many of these symptoms are associated with perimenopause, a transition period to menopause marked by irregular menstrual cycles. The researchers are hopeful that this survey data will help women get better care by making healthcare providers more aware of how frequently these symptoms, especially anxiety and mood-related symptoms, occur. There are a number of treatment strategies that are available to treat premenstrual symptoms that interfere with a woman's everyday functioning. Increasing awareness of how common these symptoms are and that they impact functioning, that there are treatments available, will help women improve their quality of life. Let us make it so. Okay, now it's time for bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. I have 17 this week. Number 1, Ohio docs say new abortion law has them working against oaths to do no harm. Not a surprise, but a story from our own state. 2, with homicide the leading cause of maternal mortality, new research shows a link to firearms and intimate partner violence. So a lot of people might not realize this, but homicide is in fact the leading cause of maternal mortality. 3, push to double up on COVID booster and flu shot may have a downside, experts caution. So what's going on here is that flu shot is very seasonal, and they're particularly this year, are pushing COVID boosters pretty early in the season. And flu shots tend to wane in their effectiveness more quickly than the COVID boosters. So if you get the flu shot really early in the season, you may have very little protection by the end of the season. So it's just a little trickier. You may want to do those separate. Get your COVID booster early and get your flu shot a little bit later. Number 4, As masks are shed, a routine visit to a medical office can pose COVID risk for some patients. So this is one of the last places to really relax. A lot of routine medical office visits, masking was pretty universal among staff and among people, patients coming in. But that's starting to relax, and not, there's kind of holes punched in that. And while a lot of research has been done on hospitals, medical offices don't have, they're crowded public places with a lot of sick people come in. And there's other research that shows with like flu-like symptoms, if you come in the same day before, after somebody who had flu-like symptoms, you're actually more likely to get the flu or flu-like symptoms after that. So going to a medical office tends to be medically risky people and people that are frankly sick at that very moment that can expose other people around. So, yikes. Number five, Biden administration is preparing for the end of free COVID vaccines as funds run dry. This could run out as early as January. Six, Pfizer isn't sharing COVID vaccines with researchers for next gen studies. So Pfizer has a proprietary vaccine. They have a monetary interest in not sharing these studies, even as I reported at the beginning of this show, doing these new next-gen studies on vaccines is really important for tamping down the pandemic as it continues. Seven, California becomes first state to test drinking water for microplastics. Woohoo! Way to go, California. Lead the way. If we don't measure it, we don't pay attention to it. Eight, why aren't federal agencies enforcing pesticide rules that protect farmers? Without protection from OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Association, administration, farm workers rely on EPA's Worker Protection Standard, which is not adequately enforced. Nine, rise in death spurs effort to raise alcohol taxes. This is sort of a follow-up of the story I did, that alcohol taxes can reduce consumption of alcohol. 10. Fentanyl test strips could help save lives. They're still illegal in 19 states. So fentanyl test strips, which somebody who is using opioids that may contain fentanyl, you can test real easily. They cost about $1 a piece. It's a very good way to avoid overdoses. They're still legal in 19 states. Now let's get to some inequity research here. First up, 11. Forehead temperature checks may miss fevers in black patients. Inaccurate readings could miss cutoffs for triggering notification pathways such as sepsis alerts. So sepsis is a blood infection, happens a lot in healthcare systems, and black patients may suffer more by not getting accurate readings. 12. Sickle cell patients face a double whammy, systemic racism and a crippling disease. Sickle cell is not covered by government research nearly as much as comparable conditions. Of course, sickle cell was present almost exclusively in black folks. 13. Black COVID long haulers felt invisible to the healthcare system, so they formed their own support groups. Sometimes you got to do mutual aid directly amongst yourselves. 14. Patient satisfaction surveys earn a zero on tracking whether hospitals deliver culturally competent care. Yikes. Again, if you're not measuring it, probably not going to pay attention to it. 15. Breaking the corporate medical playbook that silences physicians, reports of inequity. So here's a case where basically corporations silence the so-called whistleblowers or people trying to make a change rather than making the changes warranted. 16. Monkeypox is leaving working class people in financial ruin due to little or no laws guaranteeing workplace sick leave in the U.S. Just another reason for universal health care. And last but not least, 17. Agrihoods promise fresh food and community. Can they add equity to the list? Agrihoods promise to save farmland by turning it into a residential amenity. Can this effort to bridge housing and farmland support environmental justice? Yeah, so a lot of rich folks are getting agricultural lands nearby. Of course, it's as an expensive amenity. So the question is, can this be brought to a wider population? That's the environmental justice question. You can view these and all the other stories I reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-